everybody. I hope we're all doing okay in these horrible times. My name's Eamon McAdam, and this is another episode of Politically Depressed. In today's episode, I'm going to talk a lot about silence. Silence not just as the absence of noise or sound, but something that I personally am very terrified of, and I've noticed, especially over the last 3 months, something that I'm running away from constantly. And yeah, I think other people are too. But there are also other ramifications, other thoughts. When I think about silence, I start to really come up with a lot of other things and conceptions of it that I don't think I've heard other people talk about in this way. So I'm going to be talking about that. But before I do, just a few updates for keen listeners of the podcast. I bought a record player. I said a couple episodes ago that I really wanted to because I brought back my record collection from Lebanon, and I'm really excited to reconnect with that music because there are some records I have that have songs and performances that I can't find online. But there's also something special about sitting and listening to a full side of an album, which is completely different from just opening it up on Spotify or on YouTube and listening to, you know, individual songs with the ads and whatever. So the first album I listened to was the B-side of Abbey Road. I know, very normie. But it's a beautiful piece of music, especially the medley towards the end. And I really like it, and I haven't listened to it like that since Beirut, really. So yeah, that's a nice update. Definitely relates to this whole thing that I said at the offset about silence, because listening to music, it's not just avoiding silence, though, because it's not like what I have been doing otherwise, which is I rewatched the entirety of The Office, the US version, for maybe the 8th time. And that is definitely a form of just avoiding silence, you know? I'm not actually watching, even though I have no idea how there are bits of it that still make me laugh. There is a comfort, you know? I like these characters. I like seeing them again. There are jokes where I know how it's going to happen, but it's like seeing an old friend after not having seen them in a long time. Anyway, I'll get onto that when I talk more about silence. Another update is that I had my last session with my therapist on Monday, and it was a breakup session. I went in there and I told him that this is going to be the last session, and yeah, it went fine. I mean, it's not an actual breakup. He didn't try to win me back. But I did tell him everything that I've already said, that I said on this podcast. Except I didn't tell him that I have a podcast, because that would be weird. But otherwise, I did tell him, you know, that I did tell him that these sessions were once kind of helpful, but now are contributing to the problem of me feeling alienated and lonely because, you know, he's a white man that has no understanding of himself as a white man. And all the other issues, I was quite frank, I was quite happy with myself. I wasn't mean, I just was kind of forthcoming. I don't know, I just didn't feel comfortable with him in the end. And like, you know, he could be a Zionist, and I kind of felt like I would have to suss that out of him and be like, get him to say completely whatever. But it would never be enough, and even still, it's a really weird way of formulating a relationship. Or, yeah. But so I'm done with that, and I'm actually quite relieved, but also now a bit burdened by the fact that I have to find a new therapist. But that time will come. For now, you're my therapists. That's really sad. Okay. So this topic is going to be a bit dark. I've noticed, I've thought a lot about this and the ways that I'm going to talk about this, but it's going to be about the genocide in Gaza. Everything is. I can't think of anything else. I don't know how anybody else can think of anything else. And whenever I'm thinking of something else, I'm not thinking about that, you know? And I noticed that silence is scary, and I'm avoiding it like the plague. Because when I'm silent, when there's no noise around me, when nothing's happening, when I'm not talking, I'm thinking. Images are popping in my head, videos, horrible, horrible things that we've all witnessed over the last 110 days of genocide, of just every other day, the worst thing we've ever seen is topped 2 days later. It just keeps getting worse and more absurdly cruel and insane. drones with assault rifles attached to them, people being crushed to death by tanks, surviving, and the eyes. I remember after the explosion in Lebanon, feeling weirdly comforted by people's eyes, because I could see in everybody I talked to the same pain I'm experiencing, the same confusion, the same dissociation, and I understood those eyes, and I've been thinking a lot about eyes since, but I've never seen eyes like that, and I don't think we have language to describe those eyes and what they say to us about the world, about life, and what life can bring, and the misery. Jesus fucking Christ. I don't know. So, one thing I've definitely noticed when I think more about silence is that, I don't know if y'all are seeing, but there are just fewer images, fewer stories, fewer videos coming out of Gaza. And a big reason why that is because there's a very intentional, violent desire by the Israelis to create the silence. They do so by killing journalists. They have killed 110 journalists so far in 3 months, which is unbelievably unprecedented. But also with the mass killings and mass displacements, and more specifically with a siege, which has blocked electricity, internet, and has essentially created a blackout over the last 8 days. So there is an enforced silence. And the fact that we're not seeing footage isn't saying that there's not much going on, but rather that we don't know, and we may never know, what is going on right now in Gaza. We can tell from what was happening a few days ago, from the small bits that we are hearing, but actually what's happening, we don't know. And that is super fucking terrifying, because the things we do know are horrible. And so imagining and trying to hold space for the things that we don't know are happening, and we are sure is happening, but we don't know exactly what. And so how do you hold space for the pain, for the miseries that we can't see or hear about, on top of the things that we do know about? And I have no idea. And it generally is keeping me up at night. I sit there and I'm trying to sleep. And of course, I'm listening to something, I'm watching something, not The Office, but something else. Just anything. Simpsons, fucking a podcast that I've heard 1,000 times. But the few moments that I do catch myself thinking, I'm almost jolted by this realization, like, holy fuck, it is still happening. And there's not a goddamn thing that I can do about it. I have my actions, there are some things happening here and there that I can participate in, but ultimately, there is so much grief about the fact that we are impotent to stop something that is so close to home. Here I'm speaking as a Lebanese, but all my Arab friends are feeling the same way. And especially people who are in Lebanon, like, although I've heard something interesting, which I don't know how to deal with or how to compartmentalize, which is a lot of my friends back home in Beirut are saying, you know, that they have a fortune to be in Lebanon at this time. Like, there's a weird, obviously people are terrified and really worried that the war is going to expand. And obviously there's already people who are incredibly affected by de facto a war in Lebanon, you know, an Israeli aggression in the south. But there's also this feeling of camaraderie, of a joint kind of collective feeling that especially those that have lived outside know that they would feel much more intensely were they not in the country. And I know that's what I'm experiencing, which is I'm alone essentially here, and I can talk to people back home, but I can't know what they're feeling, and I feel super alienated by that fact. And I go around and I don't really live my life here. I can't really live a life. Most people I interact with, I just know are, you know, closeted Zionists, or are Zionists, or are just detached white people who are living their lives as though nothing's happening, as though they have no political agency or no political responsibility, or no even obligations to the rest of the world. They're just living in a kind of manufactured reality that ultimately will someday crumble, you know? Like, there's this kind of feeling where everybody assumes that what's happening, that politics, that war, that oppression, that violence, that misery, is something that happens on the other end of the phone, you know? That you see it, but you'll never experience it. But that world is becoming smaller and smaller, right? And eventually just will never exist. And I don't know, the white people will be the last to be aware of this fact. Part of this podcast is me avoiding silence, if I'm honest with myself, because the more I talk, the more I feel like I'm doing something, that I'm processing things, that progress is being made in some shape or form. But ultimately, I know that I am going to have to accept the silence. My mother taught me this a very long time ago. She tried to get me to do meditation many, many years ago. And she really holds this and kind of practices this, although sometimes hypocritically, because in our household growing up, the TV was always on. Like, even if my mother's doing something, even if she's on her laptop playing some game, if my brother's playing a game, we're all in the living room, the TV is just on. No one's watching. You know, my brother would be playing a game like Dota, which is like super intensive and you have to pay attention like 110% of your focus, but the TV's on. And I've picked up that habit. It's like overstimulation as a form of comfort, which is very 21st century. But there is just so much feelings of wanting to avoid silence. And there's obviously this contradiction and these paradoxes. Like, I can't totally avoid silence in the same way that I can't avoid death. It's an inevitability. And the only way to really come to terms with it is to accept it and to sort of just, yeah, accept it for what it is. But here, silence, again, is not just sitting still. Things are still happening in my mind. I am still seeing things. It's actually quite loud, in a way. But there's something else that I think about with silence, which is related to ghazza, and is a particularly painful thing for, you know, a lot of us, which is, if you watch some of these videos, any video really that's been broadcast from Gaza, there's a very distinct noise of a drone humming in the background. And that drone drove me fucking mad when I was in Beirut. It wouldn't be there all the time. It wasn't Gaza. I'm not trying to draw like a strict comparison. What's happening there and what's always happened there is just incomparable. But I know that sound. I've heard it before. And for me, at a certain time, I had to like delude myself into, you know, I'd be trying to sleep and I can hear the buzzing and I'd delude myself. No, that's just an AC unit, you know, and I'd accept my own lie. This was a period in my life where for the very first time, I was almost anti-rational. I was against the rational thinking. I would accept a certain necessary delusions, you know, if I wanted to sleep. I would have to accept this kind of what I called Schrodinger's drone or like Schrodinger's jet fighter plane, because within the ambiguity of is it a plane, is it a commercial plane or is it an Israeli warplane, I could sleep. But if I checked this app that I would like, well, I was obsessed with, this flight tracker app, and it would confirm, yes, there is a fighter jet flying over in low altitude over Beirut, I couldn't sleep because it's confirmed and it would freak me out until it kind of go away. Anyway, what I'm getting at is I read something horrifying, which is that apparently when people leave Gaza, they still can't sleep. And what happens is that they experience a certain silence, which is the lack of this drone. And this drone, again, and there are many types of drones, some of the functions of this drone is psychological warfare. It is just to keep people up at night and then to just damage them psychologically long term. So apparently when people leave, they can't sleep because it's so loud, the absence of this drone. The silence is that loud. And that really just fucks with me thinking about so many of these things. I don't know if I'm saying anything interesting because I'm just saying things and then saying that totally fucks with me because I don't know what other reaction. Like, I don't want to analyze any of these things. It feels gross just to, it would feel gross to like try to actually sit down and codify or analyze them. It also kind of reminds me of a story I have an uncle who told me about silence, that during the war, there was a thing a lot of people would say, which is that if you heard an explosion, then you're one of the lucky ones. Which, to me, it's just one of those things that I get so upset that we live in a world where there are certain conditions that create that type of knowledge, you know, that create that type of wisdom. It just upsets me so much. But another thing is that, same uncle, same story, that if he would hear a gun battle happening, you know, a few blocks over, he would be relieved because the fighting was over there and not in his, on his street. And so the inverse was more terrifying, not hearing anything, because at any moment, the gunfire could start, the shooting, the RPGs, the whatever, and it could be on his street. So there's that fear of the silence as well. And I think about that sometimes, how sometimes it's better. I kind of had this thing when I was back in Lebanon where if there was some fighting in the south between Israel and Hezbollah, I would weirdly feel good about it as opposed to the silence. Because there's this phrase in Arabic, you know, what are they cooking up? Something's being stirred up in the silence. It's a common phrase, actually, where it's like better if they're talking and threatening us, because if they're not saying anything, then it's terrifying because they're planning something. And so in a weird paradoxical way, I am at once fucking mortified whenever an Israeli official or politician or journalist comes up and says, we will destroy Beirut. We will do to Beirut what we've done to Gaza. There is a paradoxical feeling there. I'm at once terrified, because obviously a nuclear-armed superpower backed by the world's foremost military power, the US, is threatening my home city. But at the same time, if they're just saying it, maybe they think saying it has the effect that they'd want, as in literally terrorism, you know? To terrorize the entire population of Lebanon into submission. So it's paradoxical. I'm at once terrified by it, but almost comforted by the fact that they're saying it and not just like planning in quiet. They could be doing both. We have no idea. But that's the kind of liminal space that Lebanon specifically finds itself in, or rather specifically Beirut, or specifically Beirut. But I don't know. Vienna is also just way too fucking quiet. I can't stand it. It's too quiet. There's nothing. I'm recording this kind of late at night, and I'm almost afraid like a neighbor is going to come knock on my door just because I'm talking. But yeah, I'm always curious about other people, and I don't know how all of you are dealing with silence, which I know that obviously silence is just a matter of fact, you know, an experience that we don't even think about. But especially in terms of these, people call them invasive thoughts. I know that's a different thing, but functionally that's kind of what it's like, or rather it's a good framing, being silent and then these things pop in your head and we're constantly trying to avoid them and escape them by what people call doom scrolling or by watching things or constantly talking. I don't know. I'm pretty convinced everyone, at least around our age group, my age group, has a show, has a thing, you know, has some game show where they just watch over and over again, or has some show from the 90s. Am I wrong? I don't think I'm wrong. But otherwise, I would love to hear more from everyone. Again, as I said in the last episode, the responses I've been getting to this podcast have been so nourishing, and honestly, like, I don't think I could keep this up if I wasn't getting some of these responses. So if you're listening to this and you're thinking, oh, I should message him and like no, but that would be weird. I don't know him. He doesn't know me. Send it. I would love it. It'd be, honestly, I'm really alone in a lot of these things. And it's always nice to hear from other people who are experiencing them. So if you're dealing with any of these things, or if anything I've said in this episode resonates with you in a special way, and you'd like to reach out and talk about it, you can always do so on my Twitter, or I think my email is kind of a thing, or I think you can send something on Spotify for listening to this on Spotify. Regardless, this has been another episode of Politically Depressed. As always, I'm your host, Eamon McAdam. If you want to support this podcast, one thing you can do that's honestly really super helpful is leaving a review or a 5-star rating on whatever app you're using to listen to this podcast. It really goes a long way to like bolstering this podcast on the algorithm. And if you really like this podcast, then head over to patreon.com/firethesetimes. Fire These Times is a media ecosystem from the periphery that's supporting this podcast alongside a bunch of other new podcasts and media projects, including my weekly Palestine Watch Party, which happens every Sunday. Again, if you're interested, reach out. But yeah, other than that, I think that's everything. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you next week. Buddy, and welcome to another episode of Politically Depressed. As always, I'm your host, Eamon McAdam. For keen listeners of this podcast, you'll probably notice that this is a bit of a special episode. I usually release my episodes on Thursday, and this is going to be the first time that I'm releasing 2 episodes in 1 week. And the reason that is because I did something on Friday. I experienced something, I witnessed something. And I wanted to sit and record and think things out loud and express my feelings and thoughts around it while it's still, you know, like fresh in my mind and in my body. So essentially, I attended a protest here in Vienna. And it certainly wasn't my first protest. And it wasn't even my first protest here in Vienna. I've been attending protests in solidarity with Palestine for the last 3 months. But this time was a bit different, because I wasn't just another body, I wasn't just another participant in a protest whose message I agree with and that I stand in full solidarity with. This is perhaps the first time that I've attended a protest with the intention of essentially staging an intervention. You know, I largely agree with the message of this protest, but there are so many contradictions to it that I felt I had to, alongside a lot of other people, sort of involve myself, but have our voices heard and our specific demands heard. So what was this protest? Well, so first of all, I don't know if y'all have seen, like a week ago, there was this massive protest, actually several protests across Germany, protesting against the far right. Because it was revealed in some investigation that the far right, you know, alongside like the AfD, the Alternative für Deutschland party, which is a far right party, which is doing scarily well in the polls, were having secret meetings. And in those meetings, they drafted up plans for what they intend to do if they gain power. And one of those plans is a mass deportation of migrants, of refugees, of immigrants. It's really scary shit. And rightfully so, people were outraged and they went down into the streets in their droves. And at first glance, it was quite cool and quite good. But once you look a bit closer, there are numerous issues and problematics that become very clear. And that were very clear for me, because the protest I went to is kind of the Austrian version of that, you know? In many ways, Austria is the younger brother of Germany. And as a younger brother myself, I'm very aware of how younger brothers can tend to want to imitate. My brother used to call me a wannabe growing up, because it's true, I did want to listen to the same music as him, and I wanted validation from him. I don't know if that's the same dynamic between Austria and Germany, but regardless, there was a similar type of protest here, which was very vaguely, you know, against the right, against hate. And so what I'll do is I'm going to share first my experience of participating in this and participating in it in the way that I did, and then I'll follow with some of my analysis or the contextual aspects of it all, or the political and historical blah, blah, blah. Because ultimately, it's not that I learned anything new, but so many things were confirmed to me, and so many things were made very concrete, things that I've been thinking and saying for the last decade, but much more so the last 2 years since I moved to this country and found myself surrounded by white people and, you know, in the heart, in the belly of the European imperial beast, so to say. So the first thing I'll say is that I, for some reason, have hesitated to talk at all about having participated in some of these protests. And I think that reflects one of the core differences of protests here than the protests I've participated in Lebanon, which is that every protest here is registered with the police. And I don't just mean like the route or the times, but, you know, the chants and the slogans and the banners. There is very much so this feeling that it's not so much a contestation of the street or of public space, but that we are allowed to do this thing, you know, for this specific time with these specific things, and we are allowed by the state to air our grievances. But, you know, obviously that comes with limitations. And people really abide by those regulations and by those registrations. And I find myself doing it too, because here in Vienna, there in Austria, there really is this feeling of the state, you know, and of the panopticon. You kind of internalize the surveillance. You know, you always feel like the state is watching you, and you feel really scared and kind of, I don't know. So like, even me talking about these things, I for some reason already feel like I shouldn't, because I'm worried of exposing myself. But at the same time, I know that I haven't done anything illegal, because I fit within the kind of registration laws of these protests. But again, even the fact that I'm thinking, is this legal, is this not, is already the fact that, you know, they've kind of won, they're inside my head. But I mean, I think that's also, like, not just a thing of being within these really heavily surveyed and bureaucratized societies, but also it's an experience of being an immigrant, you know? I'm not in my turf. I feel very much like I'm on their turf, you know? Yeah, I just wanted to preface with that. So, this protest I'd heard about last week, and a lot of the groups that I've been participating in these Palestine solidarity protests were organizing to have a kind of block, you know, to participate in this protest, but also to say, hey, where were you all in our protests? If you care about racism, if you care about the right, then why aren't you protesting with us against the Zionist genocide against our people back home? And essentially the erasure of our voices and our demands and our attachments. But also essentially this thing that if you are going out on the streets as an anti-racist, then you are essentially speaking on behalf of those racialized, those marginalized communities. And so these Palestine solidarity groups are majority migrants and people of color. And so we didn't feel comfortable with letting all those other people speak on our behalf and say, oh yeah, we are anti-racist, where it's like, well, are you? So I went to this protest, and again, my first time not just being a body, but rather having a specific thing to say outside of the declared messages of the protest. So for the very first time in my life, I made a banner. And so I took the public transport, and I got a lot of looks. I was also, of course, donning my kufiya, which has become a thing. Maybe that's a discussion for another time, but regardless. So, like, I was quite visible, and And when I get to the tram stop, and notice there's quite a lot of people, you know, like hundreds and hundreds of people that are all walking, and of a very specific, let's say, hue, you know, very pale tones, you know, like, I mean, that's the experience of being in Vienna, but regardless, I realize that the meeting point for this Palestine Solidarity block is on the other side. I have to pass through the whole protest. And what I find was a bit disturbing in a kind of banal way, you know, for a protest against fascism, against the lurching far right, there was like just some lo-fi club music, you know, down, down, whatever. And people kind of dancing a little bit, just like as though they're waiting to get into a club. And, you know, these are white people of like all ages and whatever. And again, I emphasize that this is predominantly a white crowd. Why? Because once I cross this crowd and I get to the other side and I meet up with the Palestine Solidarity, it's complete, you know, people of all shades, of all races, of whatever. And it's this glaring dichotomy between the hegemonic and the counter-hegemonic, between the white majority and then not just like of a specific race or ethnicity, but this actual diversity of identities of whatever. And so there was a queer bloc, there was an anti-fascist bloc, there was all these things, but specifically here, just, you know, black and brown people of all shades and hues. And when I first got there, we were kind of marching towards the main protest, but we were stopped by the police. And they sort of formed a barricade in front of us, kind of blocking us from entering the actual space. I get super fucking triggered whenever I see any cops. And this is definitely like a Lebanon thing, or my stupid decisions, or whatever, my experiences back home. But then, as we're kind of standing there and we're doing our chants and the banners are being raised, these like three or four assholes kind of stand behind us and raise, you know, an Israeli flag. And I've been to a lot of these over the last 10 years, and, you know, not a lot of them, actually. It's super fucking triggering just seeing the flag live. And the only time I've seen it before was, like, 10 years ago when I lived in London, and I went to some Palestine Solidarity march, and there are always these assholes. And the thing is they're trolls, you know, they don't have any demands. They just want to trigger you and try to elicit some reaction, and then they can, you know, cry victim, which is like the tactic of the Israeli state as well, which is crazy. But regardless, so we kind of ignore them. And we keep trying to get through to the other side. And what happens is, I mean, first of all, one white dude, like typical German, I've been discovering that there's such a thing as an anti-Deutsche, like someone, usually a white German, who is so anti-German and so self-hating that they become hardcore Zionists as a way of relieving that whatever, and end up being incredibly racist and white supremacist, essentially. He walked through our crowd and was yelling, "Free Gaza from Hamas, free Gaza from Hamas." And this is like one of their new things. They love this chant. They think it's genius and it's disgusting. But we're all really trying to keep our cool. We're chanting our things. We're focused. We're not letting ourselves get distracted by these guys. But what ends up happening is that once we get a bit closer, these Zionist assholes sort of run in front of us and basically create a corridor between us and the main protest. And then the cops kind of reinforce and create these boundaries between us. So if you come just at that moment, it looks like, well, two sides, you know? And it looks like, oh, these, you know, loud brown barbarians, you know, and attack, like want to come in. But it's actually really disturbing when you think about it, because this is exactly, again, the Israeli line. Because what did the president of Israel say the other day? That Israel is a bulwark. It is a barrier that prevents the Arab barbarian from coming to Europe. And that's what this slur looked like and what they wanted to set up, which is essentially that there's this thin line of Israelis, of Zionists, that are protecting, that are stopping this horde of angry brown people from entering the main thing. So I don't know. And I don't know what to do in these situations. And we kind of were stood there and there were organizers talking to the cops and cops talking to the whatever. Bit of background as well, actually. There was actually some discussions of allowing Palestine solidarity, like in the main protest and even like to be one of the speakers. But there was literal like erasure and exclusion. And so I honestly started to get really nervous at this point because there was a vibe. There's this guy who I know who's like an older librarian. He's American, he's Jewish. And he was holding a banner that said Zionism is fascism, right? And he was like nervous as fuck. And he got really harassed and really yelled at. And I saw him like break down crying because it was just too much, you know? He was yelling and there's just, it's really difficult to be taking these stances, you know? And there's also like a lot of like random people running left and right and the cops were making maneuvers and there's this really scary feeling, you know, something is happening. And I felt this before and I started to take a step back and these situations really push me to my boundaries and I really start to consider like, what am I capable of doing? Because my instinct is to run away. But at the same time, I feel like I need to take a stand and I need to whatever. But at the same time, I don't feel like the most secure person in this country. And I don't know. And mentally and whatever. But that's a whole other discussion. But I started to feel it in my legs, like shaking and really nervous. And that lasted for about 10 minutes before some of the organizers started coming up to us. And I was with a friend who I sort of designated as my support person or whatever. And these two organizers, I think from Fridays for Future, came up to us and were asking, are you guys okay? And whatever. And it was ridiculous because one of the people I was with started saying, well, if you care about our security and our safety, then A, why are the cops facing us? If they're supposed to be protecting us, why are they facing us? And then second of all, if it's meant to be, you want to make us safe and whatever, why are you allowing these people to carry this flag, which represents a state which is enacting a genocide right now, which is just literally a hate symbol at this point. And, you know, it's not, oh, you know, we want all voices, you know, we want Arabs and racists and imperialists all in the same room talking. Like, that's not diversity. That's not equality. That's not a safe space. And she literally said something which was so revealing. She said, oh, you know, well, some organizers wouldn't even allow, you know, you to participate, but we're allowing you to be here. And there was this hubris, this who the fuck do you think you are to say you allow us to participate and to be here? Like, this is our right. And it was just another one of those examples where it's like white people cannot just sit down and listen to what we're saying. And they genuinely think that they know what to do and they know how to fix these things and how to create these spaces and how to heal the wounds that in most cases they themselves and their states and their armies have created. Okay, I'm getting a bit worked up. I'm going to scale it back. So at a certain point, there were some discussions and the police opened up and allowed us to, I don't know, there was some discussion that we're allowed to enter the main thing, but we're not allowed to hold our banners or chant. And I think everyone knew what that meant, which was they allowed us in and we just kept chanting anyway. At one point, we hear someone take to the stage and yell something about how shameful it is that at an anti-racist protest, there is a clear section where mostly black and brown people are being kettled and kept in the corner. And it's shameful, and it's contradictory, and it's hypocritical. And honestly, I never really got a sense of the space because we were kept outside of it. Once we were able to go in and I could get a better view, I could see that there was quite a lot of people. But there was very much so a division between the main protest and us. And again, us who are chanting for Palestine, for an end to genocide, for an end to colonialism, who are saying that Zionism is a form of racism and that you cannot be an anti-racist and a Zionist. It is just a contradiction of terms. But also what we're pointing out, and here I start to get into the actual analysis, is that in our sheer presence and our insistence of being present and their insistence of excluding us, they betray the very structural racism that exists and permeates the society right now. Not because of the far right, not because of something that's going to happen, but what exists right now. And I can think of so many examples and so many ways of illustrating this point. Austria is one of the few European countries, one of two, that voted against a ceasefire at the UN. There was a poll that was released only a few months ago about racism in Europe, and there was a huge long-term study of black people in Europe. And they found that not only is racism like rampant in Europe, but the two worst countries for black people in terms of experience and like daily exposure to racism is Germany and Austria. And, you know, you have the German chancellor who is like a staunch Zionist and talking about deportation, and the ways that they're talking about brown people in Germany is just horrendous and is racist. And white people don't seem to see that as a problematic. I saw a picture today, actually, that I think summed up so much of my thinking. I wish there was a way of sharing it, but essentially it was like, it's a little cartoon with two pictures. And one, there's like, I think it's a wolf living in a house with a broken roof, and there's rain, and the wolf is inside. And the second picture is it's sunny, and the wolf is poking his head outside of the roof. And it reads, "Haggis has a hole in his roof. He never fixed it because on rainy days, it was too wet to work, and on sunny days, it doesn't need fixing." And I think this so perfectly sums up why fascism is on the rise and why it's super terrifying to see white liberal people thinking that they have things under control when they just don't. You know, my experience yesterday was going to this protest and thinking, you people are unserious. Like, you are not actually prepared to fight fascism, to resist fascism. It's not going to be a party. And you only showing up now, you know, there aren't protests that often here. And if there are, aside from like the Palestine protests, it's like weird right-wing nut jobs who are protesting and organizing around like COVID conspiracy bullshit or whatever. And so there's just this real feeling at this protest where it's like, we've done our part. You know, we went to this thing and I don't think they're going to continue organizing, but they're definitely going to feel good about themselves that they've actually done something when they haven't. And actually resisting fascism takes organizing. It takes commitment. It's laborious. It's scary. It's risky. But, and I do believe everybody, you know, you can do it. But the contradictions that are so apparent at this protest, wherein there's a harsh divide of white people who are kind of talking to themselves. Oh, I should mention, there was some dickhead that was on stage that like kind of noticed the flags and said, you know, go home, you kids. That has nothing to do with what we're dealing with. And it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. The hubris that they know fascism better than us, that they know racism better than us. And they not only know how to see it, but they know what to do about it. And so, honestly, this experience yesterday was such a vivid elaboration and expression of my fears and worries that there are no adults in the room, that basically there is this lurch to the right, and the center has moved to the right, but also that the right wing are just organizing and are serious and are taking power, and the masses of people are doing nothing. And they're complacent and they're fine. And again, I'm talking specifically about white people because within this privilege, within this power structure of white supremacy, white people are kind of fine for now. But that bubble is getting smaller and smaller. And if they don't listen to black and brown people, fascism is going to come through the door or through the window. And there's not a goddamn thing they can do about it because they've already thrown anybody who can like stop it or like see it or knows the forms that it's taking completely under the bus. And, you know, it's this kind of thing of first they came for the X and then I did nothing because I'm not X. And so I think if white people are really serious about tackling fascism, they need to start listening to black and brown people, to racialized people. They need to understand their positionality within white supremacy that makes it such that there's stuff they don't see. There's stuff about themselves they don't see. There's stuff in the society that they don't see, that they don't think is a problem, that if they actually were to listen to an immigrant or to a refugee, that would be much more clear. Because people upstream, you know, downstream, smell the shit much quicker. I like this metaphor. And we smell the shit much sooner before it hits them. But once it hits them, it's already too late. And that's something that I was really afraid of with this protest, where it's like them coming out now. I'm not a cynic. I'm not saying it's too late, but it is late, you know, late for them to be seeing this thing, which people like me, like other Arabs, like Muslims have been saying for decades. Well, for me, for a decade, but regardless. So I hope I made the points that I wanted to make. There's just so much to think about and to talk about, but that protest really exemplified so many of the things that I've been thinking and talking about in terms of white supremacy, not of the fringe, but of the majority, of just most white people, of the white supremacy that they're born into, that of the world we live in. It's something that permeates our economies and the world and the ecology and everything. And so being born a white person in this white supremacist world that white people ultimately have created, or at least their ancestors and whatever, and so to recognize that and to know what the tools are to dismantle that, you have to listen to black and brown people. And if you don't, then you are essentially replicating the exact same thing that you claim to want to be destroying and dismantling, which is white supremacy. So I hope I made some coherent points there. I really wanted to share this experience because, yeah, it was a lot and I'm definitely going to be thinking about it, and again, it confirmed so much, and I don't know what to do from here on in. But anyway, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Politically Depressed. As always, if you like this podcast, please leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening to your podcasts. And if you really like this podcast, you can support it through monthly donations at patreon.com/firethesetimes. The Fire These Times is a media ecosystem project from and for the periphery, which supports this podcast and many others. So yeah, hope you enjoyed this episode, and I'll see you all next time. Everybody, welcome to another episode of Politically Depressed. As always, I'm your host, Eamon McAdam. So before we start today's episode, I want to give another brief shout out to just everyone who has written in or left reviews or ratings or even become members of our Patreon. I really appreciate it. Not only do these things really help this podcast grow, but it's like super affirming and validating. And as you all know, things have been incredibly shitty, and with that, everything feels kind of useless. So it's really nice to get confirmation that, you know, people are listening, that you are listening, but also that you appreciate this podcast enough to respond in the way you have. So I just wanted to send a message of appreciation back to all of you lovely people. So on to the actual episode. I don't know why it's been really difficult to record this. I've spent the last 2.5 hours sitting and recording and deleting and re-recording, and it's classic avoidance. And I don't know why. The thing I want to talk about is not that intense. It's certainly not more intense than any of the other things I've talked about in this podcast. But essentially, last night I watched two interviews, one with Plestia and the other with Mu'taz, both of whom are Palestinian journalists from Gaza who have both been evacuated. Plestia 50 days ago and Mu'taz like only a week ago. And both are just incredibly young. And both are clearly intensely traumatized by what they witnessed, by what they documented, and are now both in the beginning of a whole new journey of exile, essentially, and with reckoning with what happened and what is still happening, but now with them outside. And it's a whole different experience. And I started because I saw a small clip of the interview with Plestia, wherein she says that she, when she was in Gaza, she couldn't cry. There was no time to cry, as she said. And I understand that. And I want to preface this. I in no way draw any sharp comparison between my experience, between the experience of people in Beirut, and at least of the last 20, 30 years in Beirut, with what people are experiencing in Gaza. It is incomparable. And I draw these comparisons, I think, just to kind of situate where I'm coming from. I think to maybe answer the question, why is it so hard for me to do this episode? And why it's so hard to talk about these interviews? So her saying, you know, I couldn't cry when I was there, I understood that. And I felt that at a really deep level, where it's like, when I was in Beirut, I couldn't cry. Things were happening every day, constantly, and it's not necessarily the situation now, even though there's like a much more present and real war situation now in Lebanon than there was in like late 2020 when I was there. But with the economic collapse and with the explosion and with the Israeli jets, it just felt like everything was collapsing, and I felt like I was suffocating, and there was no moment to stop to cry. And one of my closest friends told me, you know, as he was preparing to leave as well, that he was leaving to be depressed, you know, that one of his goals to emigrate was to be depressed, to have the privilege to be depressed, to have some time to process, to think about the experiences, to really sit with those emotions and work through them, and to ultimately to heal. Because you cannot heal an open wound that is continuously opened every day. And that is precisely what Plestia was talking about. And so I watched her interview, and she is very strangely bubbly. I don't know how to describe it. There's like a stubborn innocence that is indescribable. Because, you know, when she's talking and she says about the horrible things that she witnessed, that she documented, one thing that she said, then I noticed Mu'taz said the exact same thing, which is the worst things that she saw, the camera didn't see. She didn't film. And that's a harrowing thing to hear. Of all the horrible videos and footage that they've documented, that they've shared with the world, to think that there was worse that they saw that they didn't show us. And a part of that is difficult to settle with, because obviously constantly thinking of how much worse can it get and compared to what we're seeing, and then confirming that it can get worse and it is worse, but also how much these people hold with them that we may never know, but that lives on in their bodies and in their minds. And we, as the people who are just witnessing this, can never really know. We can only scratch the surface. And so these first interviews, where it's a bit more personal, you know, like this interview with Mu'taz, for example, it's, I think, the first one where they ask more personal questions because he's out, he's safe, whatever. Honestly, I really question some of their choices. I know it was Al Jazeera that interviewed him, and I guess he'll be working for Al Jazeera. And I think Al Jazeera were probably pretty instrumental in his evacuation. That's just a speculation, don't quote me on that. But The person they got to interview him was a white woman, Annalise, Jorge or something like that. And I mean, I'm not this strict identity politics person. For me, it was, as I was watching it, noticing some of the questions, some of the tone, some of the ways that she's trying to keep this interview within a kind of normalcy. And Montez is just there, like, kind of just an open wound, you know? And the things he's saying and the things he's sharing is just so painful that, I don't know, I mean, hats off to her that she didn't break down crying, but I really figure, you know, if you're going to interview someone like Montez, it's like, you know, you need someone who's, like, battle-hardened, who's experienced, I don't know, like, I don't know if there even is a person that exists that could interview him and do that interview justice, you know? Probably another survivor of a genocide, of this genocide, I don't know. But the point is that it did feel a bit weird. But I don't want to focus that much on that. Even though I think that might be part of my hesitation, I think I'm afraid of replicating the exact same thing I'm criticizing. Who am I to criticize, you know, this interview? Like, I was talking to a friend about this and they asked me, what do you think would have been better questions or what would you have asked in that position? And the answer is, I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. Because it's the kind of thing of you don't want to ask someone a question and you know the answer is going to break you. I think a part of the reason that these interviews really stuck with me and really kind of hit home is because I think we all have this general tendency with trauma, with people around us and in our lives and in our communities whose trauma we don't want to approach because I think we feel like it might get on us. I had a little bit of this with my neighbor Helga, who, for those who haven't listened to the first few episodes, is my 80-year-old neighbor here in Vienna, who is essentially dying. And aside from the weird antics, I mean, actually last night she woke me up at 5 a.m. She rang the doorbell. She rang the intercom because she locked herself out again for like the fifth time. And I think I did notice that I was pushing her away instantly because I could not handle the experience of witnessing someone dying. You know, I have no hand in this. This isn't a relative. This isn't someone who I feel obliged to. But regardless, or rather because of that, I felt comfortable saying, like, this isn't my problem. You know, she has family. I mean, she literally doesn't have family, but that's what family's for, and not like random neighbors. I don't know. I don't know if I'm making any sense, but if you watch this interview, and I will link both these interviews into the show notes, first of all, one thing that sticks with you, obviously, is what they say. So both of them talk about the guilt of having survived and having left. Both talk about what they're grateful for now that they're out, now that they're safe. And it's just the most humble, basic joys of having clean water, a nice couch, a hot shower. I mean, Montez took it a step further and said, you know, I'm glad I'm not seeing bloodied bodies every fucking day and like limbs and people mourning their family that's been killed by the Israelis mercilessly. I think the one thing I'm trying to do by thinking about these interviews and what I was trying to connect with is the fact that how can we learn from these people? You know, like in thinking that these interviewers cannot actually conduct a proper interview with them, that actually I don't think anybody can conduct a real interview where they get the human story. Because to actually unravel, you know, I mean, they're clearly very hardened. Montez only just left, you know, like a week ago. He is clearly distraught. He talks about he said, no, I will never come to terms. I will never process until Gaza is healed, until the bombing stops, until life comes back to a sort of normalcy and it starts coming back to life again. Which, again, is really fucking terrifying to hear. Because if you place your mental well-being on the well-being of our region, then we are all going to die mad. We are all going to become incredibly insane. This is a lesson that, I don't know, I've been told for decades, you know? And it's definitely cynical, but I don't know how anybody can see the genocide that's unfolding and not be cynical. So what he's kind of saying is, you know, he will never be able to process. And I think one thing that makes this especially difficult for me to think about is, again, like I said, I am incredibly skeptical of any attempt to put myself in their shoes. I think there's a kind of faux empathy that some people have where they imagine that they could understand anybody's experience if they try hard enough. No, definitely not. I think that's hugely overstating one's capacities for empathy, but also understating how intensely different some experiences are, you know? So with that in mind, I think why these two interviews kind of fascinated me or kind of pulled me in, and why it's been really difficult for me to kind of say these things out loud or think about them, is because they are both entering this kind of new phase, one of exile, one of being over there and watching, and the pain, and honestly, the slowness, the quiet, the silence. Like, trying to think about Mahtez when he goes back to his hotel room, and then the phone isn't ringing, he's not watching anything. He's probably watching things all the time. The news is probably on 24/7. And some of these same things that I've been seeing in myself, in obviously a much more lessened version, but it's going to be a much more accelerated version. And how painful those moments of silence will be. And he's a young guy. He's younger than me, which is crazy. And he's got a life ahead of him. And over those years, there are going to be silences. There are going to be moments where he's going to remember. Or he's going to connect with the fact that now that he's outside, he is more impotent, potentially, to do anything. Or in general, just hearing him talk about the guilt of leaving. And that guilt is going to compound. I don't know. I think what I'm really trying to contemplate here, and I think it's something that I'm having a really hard time connecting with because it feels so almost like groundbreaking for me, or you know what I mean? Like a truth that I know I will never be able to reach, but that I will attempt to kind of have an asymptotic relationship. I don't know how to pronounce that word, but like get as close to it as possible. Which is, how do we understand the world? How do we understand human psychology? How do we understand politics and humanity and human history in a way that can hold the experience of people like Plestia, of people like Mahtez, of the millions of people experiencing genocide at the moment in Gaza? Like, I think it's one thing to listen to them, and it's another thing to incorporate their worldview into ours. As in, I think about this sometimes, you know, that a lot of people talk about listen to marginalized voices and the like, but a lot of it is lip service because, and I don't like asking this question in a way which is kind of like a gotcha, because I've realized that you lose people if you do this gotcha thing, or if it starts to become a judgment, whatever. But I will just ask this question broadly, you know? I mean, it's a podcast, so you can't take this personally because, yeah. you know, we do live in a white supremacist patriarchal world, and history is written by white men, you know, by and large. And these have been the hegemonic voices. So basically, you know, you may know some black writers, some queer writers, some Arab writers and thinkers and philosophers, but how many of them actually influence your worldview? You know, how many of them have you allowed to hold the same place as, I don't know, one of the greats, one of the old masters, your Nietzsche's or your Marx's or your, I don't know who, you know what I mean? Not just that you've read a book, but that it's foundational to how you see the world, because I think that really matters. Like, I think it's different to know what Mataz says about his experience. But then, literally, like, I want to know his thoughts about us, you know? I think, and he says this, you know, he's actually quite vocal about these things. He once wrote that, you know, how can you all call yourself free citizens if you can't stop this obvious, terrible genocide, this horrendous thing that's happening in your names? And so I think there are prescriptions, there are diagnoses of our world. And again, in a really broad sense, our understanding of psychology, of history, of politics, that aren't necessarily informed by those most marginalized. Like, those most marginalized are marginalized by many ways. And one of them is that they can only speak about their marginalization and that's it. But they can't and are not allowed to speak broader. Whereas at the same time, you have the most mediocre white idiots who are lauded as geniuses. I mean, there's a thousand names. Jordan Peterson, who? I mean, there's another one, actually. This actress, Deborah Messing, I think she was one of these, you know, Will and Grace. I think she was Grace. She made fun of Mataz on Instagram, and someone asked him about it, and his response was, who? Like, who is this? Who in the white woman? What? And I honestly, that's something that's been happening to me these days. So many institutions and so many individuals have exposed themselves to be complete frauds, to be unserious people. I can't take anyone seriously who, I mean, at the moment, whose hearts aren't incredibly broken because they have no empathy. I can't take anyone seriously whose analysis does not incorporate the current genocide because they don't have a brain. But it's just this feeling that, like, every layman, every ordinary person in Lebanon, in Palestine, in Syria, and in Sudan, every utterance of every street cleaner just holds so much more weight than your bureaucrats here, your politicians, your journalists, your white, deluded, you know, on such levels of privilege that they've ceased to become relevant. I don't know how else to say it. There's so many people, and it's become obvious that this isn't just like a bad apple situation. This is like mind-blowingly prevalent. These are just unserious people everywhere. And some of them hold the highest offices in the land. Who the fuck is Joe Biden? Who is he? Like, really, genuinely, who the fuck is he? To say anything, to have an opinion, to have any authority, moral or political or intellectual, he's meh, you know? I don't know what to say. But same goes for so many journalists and so many activists and so many feminists and so many queer rights activists and so many institutions. And I'm just sick of it. I'm just so sick of the fact that it's just so normal here and in the West in general to essentially be a genocide denier, to be a genocide apologist. And it's taken as like either a legitimate point or like so tangential, it's like not part of the whole. Seeing that actually not as a margin, but seeing it as the center, you recognize that the person's whole worldview is fucked. I've gone on a massive tangent. I don't think I've made any single coherent point in this whole episode. I just think there's so much to learn from people who experience this insane levels of violence. And again, not just about their experience, not just about the violence, but about life. You know, it's like for Matez to say that, like, he's super grateful for a clean glass of water. We should all be grateful for a clean glass of water. We should be fighting for the fact that we still have clean water. Because, you know, I just think things are going to get shittier for everyone, everywhere. And it's about time we wake up to that fact. And the people who can tell us about what the apocalypse is going to be like are the people who have already experienced their own apocalypse. And so that's why I have no time for white science fiction writers, because if you just listen to what a Palestinian has experienced in the last 3 months and like really understood, it's more than any white science fiction writer could ever imagine. And it's just much more relevant because it's much more real, because it is real. Oh, it is real. Okay, always end with a joke, I guess. I think I made all the points that if I'm going to make, these are the ones I'm going to make. I'm really sorry for a very sloppy episode. I hope you still enjoy this. And I think, yeah, that's another episode of Politically Depressed. If you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving a 5-star review or a rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you really like this podcast, head over to patreon.com/firethesetimes. And for as little as $5 a month, you can really help support this podcast and the wider media project, The Fire These Times. So yeah, thank you all for listening, and I'll see you all next week. Everybody, welcome to another episode of Politically Depressed. As always, I'm your host, Eamon McAdam. I've got a small announcement to make before I start this episode proper, and it's a bit of an invitation. Once a week, every Sunday, I host something called the Palestine Watch Party, which is basically just an online screening with a discussion attached to it. This month, we're watching 3 really excellent documentaries: Jenin Jenin, Children's of Shatilo, and My Neighborhood, which stars an 11-year-old Mohammed al-Kurd. I prioritize films by Palestinians and about Palestine, and the discussions that we've been having have been really fantastic. And so, if you like this podcast, you'll probably enjoy those discussions and hopefully those films as well. And yeah, happens once a week on Sundays over Zoom. If you're interested, reach out either through Twitter or Instagram, or I guess through the app you're listening to this podcast on. I'd love to have you all there. And yeah, that's that. A Palestine watching party. Sorry, watch party. Ugh. So today's another difficult topic. I mean, obviously, the podcast is called Politically Depressed. But I don't know, it's the same thing that I experienced last week, wherein I've recorded this 3 or 4 times, and I get about 10 minutes in, and I just completely lose steam. And for some reason, I insist on starting from the beginning. It's kind of this feeling wherein it's still not natural. I do hope I get to the point where I can just sit and record, and it'll take like an hour. But I guess my hesitation to even actually start is, again, another sign of avoidance. These are topics that are not easy to think about, let alone share. And I really hope that even though this episode will be more self-indulgent, you'll allow me to take the time. I mean, this whole podcast has been kind of self-indulgent, but I keep trying to hit that like thin line wherein it's still, you know, relevant. I do believe that the personal is political, but I don't like involving myself too much. Navel-gazy is another term that I'm really afraid of being associated with. but yeah. Basically, I've been having issues with my partner, and for the sake of this story, my partner is white. They're Austrian, and obviously I'm here to share the kind of political themes that I've been reading into my recent troubles. The thing is I don't like myself these days, obviously. You know, I'm useless. I'm crying half the time, or I'm kind of inert on the couch, playing the same stupid game over and over again, rewatching The Office again. I mean, I'm doing other stuff, but functionally, there have been a lot of days where my partner comes home and I kind of still haven't gotten out of bed, functionally. And sometimes I'm kind of mute, you know, not really able to communicate. But a reason that I think exacerbates that is that I have been feeling more and more, and especially over the last 3 months, but obviously over the last few years, that we are increasingly inhabiting these split worlds. You know, I described this in an earlier episode, that there really feels like different realities, that those of us who have experienced trauma and political violence and oppression and have like left our homes, or, you know, now especially people who are facing genocide, but also just conflicts throughout the region and the global south in general. And so as someone who's in a relationship, who's in a loving relationship, you know, very intimate one, with someone who is still in that other world, which, you know, I read things materially, and it's not just a separate world. It is the same world, but that is a very privileged position, and it is one that is premised on power and violence, and is kind of, you know, superimposed upon the other. That is to say, they're not actually separate. Like, one is premised on the other in the way that, you know, the global north can only exist with the global south. I'm going on another tangent. I think that's obviously a symptom of A, the avoidance, but B, the issues themselves, because it's very difficult to just get into the personal. When you're talking to your partner, it's not you're talking to a political subject. You're talking to someone who you want to keep close, and you want them to be aware of the things that they are doing, or that they might not even know that they're doing, but because they exist in these worlds that are so hegemonic, that they may not know that they're doing it. That there are these barriers that make it difficult to meet. And so this really came to a head, and the reason that I thought about making this episode to begin with is because a couple of weeks ago, I decided to ask my partner a question, which I needed at the moment. I asked them to tell me that everything is going to be okay. And reflexively, they did. They said everything's going to be okay. But I felt nothing. And I said so. I said, I don't believe you. And there was a kind of silence, because it was like, well, what now what? I think the only person that I can believe for some reason when they say that is my mother. And I am someone who is very much so away from my mother. I miss her so much. It's been 2.5 years now, and I've only seen her, you know, a few days. We talk often, but it's just not the same. And I really feel like I'm lacking that affirmation. I'm constantly really scared, and obviously things are scary for a lot of reasons. But for me, very specifically, like, I'm scared of how the society here is, you know, and is transforming and is becoming and is exposing itself as. And I feel very alone, because I don't have community here. And so the only community I do have is with my partner. So I need that feeling of being protected by them, you know, in a society that is functionally theirs. But the reason that I can't feel satisfied with their answer, because I don't think they know, that I feel like an adult sometimes. And I don't want to feel like the adult in the room all the time, because I have no idea what the fuck's going on. And I don't even know how to control my own emotions, let alone control whatever's happening in the society that I don't know anything about, that I don't even speak their language. And so there's kind of that feeling that there are so many things that I know they don't know. And part of the reason why I know they don't know is because they're not freaking out all the time, you know? I find myself sometimes literally saying, you know, sometimes I feel like I want you to be more depressed because somehow they're functioning. And obviously, and we have this conversation a lot, that they are upset, but I don't feel it. Like another really big example that I've brought up to them several times, and it's really difficult to internalize because I feel really unfair when I say this, but okay, I think I found a good way of phrasing it yesterday. Because yesterday, a similar thing happened wherein my partner came home and was just in a happy mood to see me, you know? So it feels really, really fucked to be like, I can't handle your happiness because I'm so depressed and I'm so upset that you're happy, you know? That I know your happiness is premised on an ignorance of my pain. And so I summed it up pretty well, I think. I told my partner, I need you to greet me. I need you to treat me as though I'm in mourning, because I am. You know, I'm in mourning, I'm furious, I'm terrified. There's a lot of fucking shit going on, and it's not normal. And your insistence on making things normal is constantly clashing with my experience of reality, and it's like a constant gaslighting. It really reflects my experience of being here in Austria in general. Like, every advertisement I see feels like a gaslight. You know, every time I go to the streets, every time I just hear white people laughing, it just feels like a gaslight, you know? Like, they're laughing, but in their laughter, it fucks with my understanding of reality. Because my idea of reality is so premised on collapse, which I know if I go to a therapist would tell me like, oh yeah, you're definitely traumatized. But like, fuck that. Because we're all going to become traumatized. And if you don't understand trauma as like an affect, as something that people live with, that people continue living with, that like politics is premised on trauma in so many cases, and increasingly with climate collapse, with, you know, like understandings of colonialism and the reactions to colonialism, especially like authoritarian ones and blah, blah, blah. I don't want to get into a whole historical analysis here. My point is just that, okay, one final example, and I feel unfair doing this whole episode. I've already obviously checked this with my partner, but I'm sure this is still going to be a bit like difficult, but I really can't emphasize this enough, that I think this is a general problem. I don't think this is just something between me and them, but this is a problem with white people and white people in relations with the rest of the world, you know? Because I think the only people that won't benefit from hearing from this are white people that only hang out with other white people, you know? And I don't know what to say to them, but, you know, that's kind of a problem. We were out at dinner, and the same thoughts were kind of piling up in my head. I had went for a walk by myself earlier that day to kind of try and clear my head, but I guess it didn't, like, you know, I didn't get the things out. I just kind of... Yeah, I've really been in my head way too much these days. Like, even when I talk to people, I'm still in my head. But anyway, a big reason why I'm doing this episode is because even though I thought I'd kind of, like, cleared things up with myself, on our way to dinner, I still found myself kind of lashing out. And I hate that. I hate lashing out. It feels cruel and immature and oftentimes unfair and unproductive, you know? I don't want to hurt their feelings. But it's just a lashing out that comes from not being heard and not being understood. But I did lash out and I felt really bad and I had to like analyze why that was. And then I think I came up with a question that did sum it up. What I asked my partner over dinner, at this very nice Persian restaurant, actually, it's one that I discovered, it's run by these two old ladies. Love it. It's great. It's one of my only like favorite restaurants in the city, which otherwise the food really sucks. Anyway, I do come up with a question, which is, how many times have you cried over the last 120 days? And they said none. And I said, that's exactly the problem. Like, this is it. This isn't building up to something else, you know? This is the one of the worst things that can happen to a people, and to a people that are very close to my people, that are very close to the world. You know, this is an indigenous people being massacred and genocided by a colonial army. Okay, I'm gonna slow myself down there, because... And it hasn't moved you. And my question that I always have for Europeans, particularly, I mean, white Europeans, is what will it take to move you? You know, that's a really scary question. For me, the answer is very scary, because we're ultimately finding that nothing is moving them. And at a time when we need internationalism, we need Europeans to wake up. These are people with immense power and privilege and are still living in some of the last remnants of democracy, you know? And I think that's a really important thing, actually. It's that when I push on this point more, you know, there's such a numbification, a self-numbification, because there's this feeling we can't do anything. And again, I think of what Mu'tez says, you know, the Palestinian journalist, when he accuses people in the West of saying, you are not free people. If you cannot stop this genocide, if you cannot even get your governments to do the bare minimum, you know, you are not living in democracies. And I think a lot of people here are still living under the delusion that they are. And I think that's something big that this like anti-right wing march in Germany and here in Vienna kind of really exposed, which is the political impotence of the sort of average white European, even though they exist with such privilege, but they don't act on it. And a part of it is because, well, there are a lot of reasons, but a big part of it is they don't feel politics. I don't know, I very rarely have had discussions with people. Actually, here's a very funny story. I was in a call with a few friends, and one of them, this Armenian friend, said that they were describing Lord of the Rings to their mother. And their mother was like, whoa, those dwarves, are they Armenian? And she's like, wait, what? And it's like, oh, these, you know, really angry people who are super upset that their mountain was stolen from them. You know, they sound like Armenians. And it was funny. And then I said, because I don't know much about Lord of the Rings lore, I asked, wait, who stole the mountain from them? And she said, the elves. But then someone else said, Smaug. And then they started arguing, and I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. I think I felt for the very first time something, which is what I imagine people feel like when other people talk politics. Because I don't care if it's the elves or Smaug. I didn't even know there was a conflict. I'm only just coming to this conversation now, and I already don't care. Like, you're getting way too invested in this. I found that really funny, because it was the very first time I'd ever experienced something similar to, like, yeah, what I imagine white Europeans feel like when you talk about Palestine, where it's like, yeah, well, they say this, you say this, whatever, can't you just get along? Like, can't you just agree? Like, it's just a disagreement. I think this returns to the very premise, the thesis of this podcast, which is, I do think we need to start reckoning with feeling politics. You know, I think once you cry over Palestine, and not just, I don't know, shake your head in disagreement or go yell at someone. Once you feel the grief, once you sort of, A, you are sort of pushing yourself out of that comfort zone, which is the hegemony of white supremacy and patriarchy. You are feeling for a second what people have been feeling for decades. But you also start to see things differently. and your priorities shift. And I think, you know, another thing that my partner says often, which is, what can I do? Or rather, what can I do? You know? And it's sort of a rhetorical question, because it's the beginning and the end. And so I pushed them and I said, so what can you do? You know? If you were to really feel and internalize the pain that I've been trying to share with you, you know, instead of rejecting it, I think it wouldn't be a rhetorical question anymore. You would generally be asking, what can I do? Because ultimately, with the rise of like right-wing fascism in Europe, if like the bulk of people don't wake up, don't enliven themselves, you know, the right are organizing. God, I don't want to go into a circle again. Y'all know, because y'all have been listening to this podcast, and it's just, I really think, unless we want to continue, and here, when I say we, I'm talking in a very weird way, because I'm sort of putting myself in the shoes of the white European, you know, in this kind of way of constantly doing the work that, honestly, I don't think should be put onto my back, should not be put on the back of the person who is, you know what I mean? This is the kind of unfairness of these things, that it is the marginalized who has to come up with the theory, not those that are like benefiting and comfortable with their marginalization. I'm not saying I'm marginalized, but you understand what I'm saying. I don't want to play victim here, but, you know, compared to the white European, you know, I'm not doing so hot. But so, if we want to break out of this incredibly polarized, and I mean emotionally polarized, like I just can't meet, I can't hang out with people, I can't be in the same space with white people because their laughter irritates me. I think we have to start feeling these politics. I think white people really need to start really working to break the numbness that is global capitalism of the 21st century, of Instagram, of the algorithms, but also break from white supremacy, to recognize Palestinian pain as real, Palestinian blood as real, and Armenian pain as real, and Sudanese pain, but also not just fall to despair, or not just get stuck in asking, what can I do, what can I do, what can I do? Like, really just spend time with it, and think about what can you do, and connect the dots, and just listen. There's so many resources out there about what you can do. And some of it is like starting from home, you know? Like, it's a scary fact that white Europeans cannot influence their governments, that people in the US are being led by a stupidly unpopular president who is basically dying. And the alternative to that morbidly reactionary, genocidal president is another morbidly reactionary, genocidal president. I don't know. We're living in incredibly scary times, and I'm not so much worried about the right-wing nut jobs as I am about the masses of just white centrists, of the so-called apolitical people, for whom they will be the last to see the terror and the horror. But I think it's coming for everybody. And yeah, again, I feel like I'm going to end a lot of my episodes like this, but we're all fucking doomed unless something changes. And so, yeah, always end on a high note. So yeah, that's been another episode of Politically Depressed. As always, I've been your host, Damon McAdam. If you like this podcast, please consider leaving a 5-star rating or a review on whatever podcast app you're listening to this episode on. And if you really like this episode, head over to patreon.com/firethesetimes. The Fire These Times is a media ecosystem based in the periphery that supports this project alongside a bunch of other media projects. And for $5 a month, you can really help this project grow. And that's been it for me. I'll see you all next week.